Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Central Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nick C., a host of the channel. Today I'll be talking with my guest, Dr. James Pickett, about his new book, Polymaths of Islam, Power and Networks of Knowledge in Central Asia, published in 2020 by Cornell University Press. James Pickett is assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Pittsburgh, where he teaches Central Eurasian and Persianate history, as well as the history of Imperial Russia and the Soviet Union. He received his PhD from Princeton University in 2015. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Nick, for that kind introduction. It's a little, in some ways, a little intimidating to be here. I've been listening to the New Books Network podcast for so long. It's finally to be on it with talking about my own book. So thanks so much.
Yeah, and we're really excited to have you. And I really enjoyed this book. You know, to kind of get into our discussion today, I wanted to start by asking you about your motivations for researching this topic. How did you come to write a book about the kind of Persianate, or a book about Persianate Islamic intellectuals in early modern Central Asia?
Sure. Yeah, and I have to say, you know, I'm always quite jealous when I hear the answers that other guests of the show offer, because, you know, they always have such great stories or personal connections. And I don't really have either of those things. You know, I have no deep connection to the region before I started studying it. But I did. I have been interested in the history of Islam for quite a long time. And it just so happens that I went to a small liberal arts school for my undergraduate called Carleton College, where Adib Khalid is, you know, a scholar there and a teacher there. And I took his classes and really fell in love with the history of the region. So it was really happenstance that I think that pulled me down this road. Although I will say that for me, the kind of the gateway drug was the realization that a part of the Soviet Union, a communist state, was Muslim. And you know, obviously that won't be news to anyone listening to this podcast. But when I was a freshman in undergrad, I found that just fascinating. And that also that was through, you know, Adib Khalid's classes. And that, even though my research now primarily focuses on the pre-Soviet period, that was what really sucked me in to the study of Central Asia. So it's probably more happenstance than anything else. I could also add, though, just that out of college, I became involved in a blogging network called New Eurasia that was trying to promote citizen journalism in the region. And this, if there was any question that I was going to study Central Asia before that, that really solidified my interest, because it provided a way for me to visit the region, but also really get my, get some experience writing about it. So
that's really fascinating. And, you know, you're really lucky, and it's not surprising if you had a professor like Adib Khalid teaching you about Central Asia that you would kind of be inspired to continue on that path. But I'm curious about, you know, you've kind of talked about your interest in Central Asia overall, but how did you come to this focus on specifically the Persianate or the Persianate world? Because in your book, it's a very specific focus that you have, and you have, it seems like you have very strong ideas about how kind of Persianate culture operated in early modern Central Asia. So when did you start to delve more deeply into that subject matter?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I imagine we'll get more into the sort of specifics of what that term means and some of the different takes on it in a moment. But in terms of its relationship to why I got interested in Persianate culture and also in the ulama, is that's somewhat straightforward. You know, I remember when I was doing sort of the pre-dissertation research trip, I was spending most of my time in post-Soviet Central Asia. But then I went and did some very brief work in the archive in Kabul in Afghanistan to assess what sort of materials might be there to work with. And, you know, there are more, you know, on paper, there are more Tajiks living in Afghanistan than in Tajikistan. And I had spent by that point quite a bit of time living and traveling and working in Central Asia. So I expected that the sort of the cultural gulf, you know, I'd find a lot of things in common. And of course, there are a lot of things in common, but I was more struck by how much changes when you cross that border between post-Soviet Central Asia and the territories to the south. And the reason that interested me is because during the time period I studied, that wasn't the case. As in, you could travel that, you know, across the Amu Darya River and much further. And the cultural world, particularly at the elite level, was fully commensurable. And I just found that so, so interesting. I wanted to understand the world before the Soviet rupture. And I was interested in those long-term and geographical continuities. And the sort of Persianate studies and what we'll you know, get into as the Cosmopolis was the way that I made a sense of that phenomenon.
Yeah, let's talk about this term Cosmopolis, because, you know, as somebody who is kind of delving into early modern Central Asia, it's not like my main area of focus. You know, this was something new to me. Is that a term that you've come up with to describe your research, or is this part of an existing literature and you're kind of building on it? I guess, could you describe what you mean by the Persianate cosmopolis for our listeners? And how does that help you understand what's happening in kind of intellectual circles in early modern Central Asia?
Absolutely. The first thing is both the term Persianate and Cosmopolis are parts of existing literature that I'm building on, but I did not coin either of those things. And I'll explain how what I'm doing fits into those scholarships. But let's back up for just one second. And, you know, anytime you introduce words that in scholarship that people aren't even educated readers are not necessarily familiar with, that you need to justify that. And in this case, I really do think that those categories are in a way practical solutions to a practical problem. And the practical problem is this, which is that, you know, when we're talking about the way that culture and religion and literature functioned in the pre-modern period, you know, anything before, say, the 20th century, most of the categories that are our default categories that we turn to are modern ones, which is to say primarily national ones. So this is why you get so many debates about whether this or that, you know, cultural artifact is really Uzbek or really Tajik, that sort of thing. What people are doing is applying these national categories to a time period when they don't really have any, role to play. It's sort of like, you know, trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. So the terms like Persianate and ideas like Persianate and Cosmopolis help us get away from that and start looking at this this cultural ecosystem on its own terms. And you might think, well, one way of getting away from that is just to use a larger regional category like Central Asia. But Central Asia, you know, is a term that I use in the book, but it's a category of convenience. It's a modern area studies category. It doesn't really have any organic basis in the region's history itself. So it's not really a solution to that problem either. What this term cosmopolis is trying to capture? Part of it is that pre-modern elite cultures were astonishingly uniform across both time and space. But again, the elite qualifier there is an important qualifier. You know, we're talking about a very narrow slice of the population. Yet we're talking about a very, you know, what I'm getting at is that, culture produced in the medium of, say, Arabic or Persian, were had a lot of continuity across many centuries and across a huge amount of territory. Another thing that the person who coined the term cosmopolis was a scholar named Sheldon Pollack, and he was actually formulating it in relation to Sanskrit. But the model works very well in many different cultural contexts. Another scholar named Alexander Beecroft has done a great job of sort of extrapolating on that model and showing how it applies in many, many different parts of world history. Purpose that these conceptual tools serve is to help us think about the relationship between different language cultural formations, namely the fact that they are nested. So, for instance, Persian high culture, so Persian language literature, that sort of thing, it borrows a lot. You know, you can't overstate how much it borrows from Arabic, right? It's assuming the Arabic curriculum, literature, it's been borrowing words from it, and so forth. And then Turkic borrows tremendously from Persian, thereby borrows from Arabic. So these languages and literary complexes are kind of nested within one another. That's a very big picture way of looking at it. But when I get into some of the different questions more specific to 19th century Central Asia that my book's trying to answer, I turn to that model a lot to explain, for instance, why it is that a scholar could, say, move from Bukhara to a place like Kabul or Balkh and you know, not miss a beat and have his or her skill set and forms of knowledge fully commensurable and transferable.
Yeah, and I think we'll get to that below. I wanted to kind of tease out something that you said earlier in your answer. You were talking about kind of the way that, I don't know, if we want to call it like national identities and national historiographies, or kind of history seen through a national lens in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, especially kind of shaped the way that history of the 19th century has been written. Could you talk about that a little bit more? I mean, how does this relate to the kind of standard division we see in Central Asian history of sedentary populations versus nomadic populations, or Turk versus Tajik? More specifically, like how does your work disrupt that, or maybe not disrupt, but move a little bit beyond that?
Great. That's a great way to put some more specificity on how this model relates to Central Asian history. So first of all, you know, a paradigm very common in Central Asian studies, you know, nomadic versus sedentary. I fully embrace that. That works very well. I think the problems start when you try to map that specifically to identity. So you say, oh well, the nomads are Turks and the sedentary people are Tajiks. It's much messier than that. And so, you know, for instance, you imagine someone coming from a Turkic nomadic background. They come to, so they probably speak some dialect of Turkic. It could be, you know, something close to modern Uzbek. It could be something close to modern Kazakh. It could be something, you know, in between, something else entirely. So they come to Bukhara, and what do they do? They need to learn. So the madrasa lessons are taught in Persian. So first they have to learn Persian as a way of accessing yet another curriculum. So, you know, again, these are, if we're thinking in terms of identity, you know, there's an argument to be made that there's some kind of Turk, I guess, you know, they're speaking Turkish, like some dialect of Turkic at home, but then they're engaged. Their first step is to learn some kind of Persian, literary Persian, as a means of accessing a predominantly Arabic curriculum, in the madrasa. So, you know, they're engaging all three different kinds of nested high cultural formations. You know, Arabic via Persian, maybe via Turkic. I mean, they're talking to each other. They have study guides in Turkic. They're getting tips from their classmates. So it's really hard to, you know, what is that? I mean, I don't think it's a. If you're asking what is that in terms of, is that really a Turkic identity, really an Uzbek identity? Those questions just don't, you know, they don't make sense in a way that the sources can really answer. But I do think that thinking in terms of how they're engaging the cosmopolis is much more useful. So, you know, they're engaging the Persian cosmopolis and thereby tapping into the Arabic Islamic cultural formation, which the Persian assumes and takes for granted and incorporates. I guess, you know, to answer, like, one of the ways that I, so again, these concepts are ones that I'm building on, but I'd say that my work intervenes them in maybe three sort of specific ways, which relate to what you just asked. One is that, you know, I don't think of the Persianate as a kind of identity. I think of it, you know, as in a way, if you think of identity as something that that people are self-consciously identifying as, it's a modern term invented in the last 20 years, 30 years. So, you know, how could it be? People are not thinking of themselves as Persianate, obviously. So I'm thinking about it more as in terms of a curriculum, as a canon of literature that people are engaging. And that literature and that writing shapes their worldview, shapes the way they understand the world. But it's not, at least in a narrow definition, I don't really think of that as an identity. The second thing is, you know, the term Persianate is not all. So I'm making an argument for it that we ought to consider it as sort of a subset of Islamic, something that assume that was permeated with Islamic terminology and concepts that were drawn directly from Arabic literature. And therefore, and that's the way to think of it, which is not the way it's always used. Other people have, you know, will use the term Persianate as something that's, you know, maybe like sometimes even a secular layer on top of Islamic. So I think but for my purposes, it's important to consider the way that that Persianate high culture assumed and took for granted that Arabic, you know, in the case of Bukhara, that very palpable Arabic curriculum that's undergirding and informing the Persianate layer on top of it. The same way Turkic, which was Turkic as a especially written Turkic, was not as common in Bukhara as it was elsewhere, but it existed there as well, and it was layered on top of the Persianate, which was layered on top of the Islamic. And the third thing, you know, and the reason this is useful for my work is just, you know, occasionally, because it's Persianate studies have often been connected with literature and studies of literature, I think it's, you know, I emphasize in my work that we have to remember that being the social group, i.e. the ulama, who speak for this high cultural corpus, this canon, and can authoritatively write new, make entries into it, can interpret it, that carries with it tremendous power. I mean, it's you're describing how kings ought to behave. You're describing who is properly Muslim or not. So their undisputed status as the interpreters of Islam, but also this cultural milieu of this Persian cultural milieu, which were intertwined, that is a big part of what made the ulama such a powerful social group.
Yeah, and I want to dive more closely into Bukhara and you know, which plays a central role in your book as kind of one of many Persianate kind of centers. So this is a center of Islamic learning. But what I really liked about the book is that we actually can trace the origins of Bukhara coming, you know, Bukhara-i Sharif, I think you mentioned, like the Bukhara the Magnificent and you kind of, you know, standing from 2020 or 2021, it seems that Bukhara has always been this kind of magnificent place and you know, its splendor is sort of timeless in a way. You know, that's even if you watch Central Asian films from the 20th century, you kind of see this. But what you seek to do is kind of actually trace the origins of Bukhara as kind of this special place for Islamic learning. And to do that, you also kind of set the chronology of your book, which is within some, you know, you use this phrase, the long 19th century. Mm-hmm. So can you tell the listeners a little bit, what do you mean by long 19th century? And why is Bukhara over Balkh, which you also mentioned, or some of these other centers of Islamic learning so important? What does it tell us about some of the questions you're seeking to answer?
Great. So I'll take Bukhara in relation to periodization. You know, not only do I call it the long 19th century, kind of half jokingly, I refer to it as the even longer 19th century, stretching from Nader Shah's conquest in the middle of the 18th century up until the Bolshevik conquest of Bukhara in 1920. And so it was a little bit tongue in cheek, but it is making that periodization is doing something also serious, which is one thing is that it's not using, it's repurposing something, you know, a term specific to European history using non-European boundaries. So it's trying to disrupt that. But with the purpose that, you know, very common in a very common chronology, a very common periodization is thinking about the pre-colonial versus the colonial periods in scholarship, which is, you know, for some questions, that's fine. But, you know, I wanted to look at it a little differently and sort of try and transcend that divide. So part of the, what I'm doing with the long 19th century, you know, the even longer 19th century is using it as a periodization to get beyond the colonial, pre-colonial thing. You know, I'm not necessarily promoting it as something that everyone should use. You know, there's the different, you know, different periodizations work well for different, you know, research questions. But for what I'm doing, I do think that this, you know, it makes a certain kind of sense. So for instance, if you're, you know, Nadershah's so Nadershah was a conqueror, you know, an Iranian conqueror that, you know, essentially his conquest reset the political landscape, you know, over wide swaths of Persianate Eurasia, not just in Bukhara. You know, he broke the back of the Mughal Empire, new dynasties in Iran, the Durrani dynasty of Afghanistan and the Mangat dynasty of Bukhara both owe their origins to service in Nadershah's military empire. And then also, and so that's on the one, that's a, as a, you know, as one possible, beginning to this period. And then in the, as I explained in the epilogue of the book, for the madrasa elite culture that this book is looking at, I do think the Soviet period does mark a hard rupture for this kind of Islamic culture, not for all kinds of Islam, as many other scholars have very aptly shown, you know, Islam survives in all sorts of ways during the Soviet period, both officially and unofficially. But for this world of the ulama, at least in the way that I talk about them, you know, their time is very limited once the Soviet period starts. So that's the work. That's the work that the periodization is doing for my work. And just a quick, like, you know, one last note on periodization. You know, I do think that in some ways I see this work fitting in to the early modern period in a very serious way, even though it goes into the 19th and even 20th century, we can trace, and for some of the reasons I was describing related to the use of this word, this term cosmopolis, the Persian cosmopolis, one of the comments I made was that it's very enduring both in space, but also in time. And so the ulama that I'm studying are engaging with an enduring tradition that goes back, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. Okay, so then the second part of your question was about, you know, Bukhara specifically and how Bukhara as a place fits into this periodization. Is that correct?
Yeah, and you know, why specifically Bukhara? Because as you mentioned, there are other kind of Persianate centers. I mean, presumably you could have written a book about Balkh or something like that. And would you have come up with a similar story, you think, or is there something unique about Bukhara?
Okay, great. I see. Yeah, no. So, Bukhara, you know, so this really gets to the sort of argument in chapters 2 and 3, which is, you know, the story of how Bukhara, in a way reached its cultural religious zenith, during this particular time period, the early modern period as a whole, but also especially the long 19th century, which is to say, you know, so on the one hand, I am kind of, deconstructing a little bit the claim that you'll hear even today, in some ways, most of all today, about Bukhara's timelessness, you know, the idea that it has always been a pinnacle, you know, an Islamic center in the region. And from the early Islamic period, and even the late Sogdian period and the pre-Islamic period, you know, Bukhara is an important cultural center. But there were ebbs and flows to that. Specifically, you know, at different points in time, you can talk about, as you mentioned, Balkh, but also especially Samarkand, especially in the Timurid period, as eclipsing Bukhara, right? So if you, you know, if you're living in, say, the 15th century, Bukhara would be an important city. You know, you have very important scholarly dynasties that other scholars have sort of traced the fates of. But if it was, at the very least, places like Samarkand were peer competitors. But in the early modern period, when the capital of the Shibanid dynasty shifts over to Bukhara, and you have a tremendous investment in the infrastructure of the city. By the time we get to the time period I'm looking at, Bukhara really is the uncontested center of the region in terms of cultural, political, and for my purposes, religious and cultural life. It's serving as a magnet that's pulling in scholars to study there from far beyond the political boundaries of the city-state itself. So Muslims are coming in the thousands from the Volga Urals in Russia, from India, from what is now Western China. And so there's a history to this. The long 19th century, building on the infrastructure and the cultural development in the early modern period, is when Bukhara really achieves this status as a peerless center of Islam and Persian and high culture, and in a way that overshadows neighboring cities that were still really important centers in their own right, like Kashgar and Samarkand and Balkh and places like that. But still, it had an outsized allure compared to those other places in this period, maybe not in earlier centuries.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and what's really interesting to that about that point is that it also kind of reminds us that these, especially the Afghan border, is so incredibly recent. I was somewhat anecdotally, I was at a conference once talking to some Afghan students about a paper that I was writing about Bukhara and kind of cultural representation of Bukhara. And they said, there was this long tradition of lamenting the loss of Bukhara to the Soviets in 1920. And that kind of shocked me a little bit. But now that I'm reading your book and kind of thinking about the longer place of Bukhara in the region, that shouldn't be so surprising. So I think, that's really interesting to see how kind of that plays out over time. But I want to shift the focus of our conversation a little bit and kind of get into the meat of the book and kind of the sources that you're relying on. So, there's a huge focus on kind of this intellectual elite, the ulama, in your book, and you're kind of looking at how they've changed and transformed over the long 19th century, but also how the kind of literary and educational institutions that they're operating in are remarkably persistent, even through, the period of Russian colonialism. So can you talk a little bit about the group that you studied and what kind of sources you're using to get at their stories and explore how this kind of intellectual tradition operated?
Yeah, so I mean, to back up just even a step, so ulama is an Arabic term that means those who know, those who are knowledgeable. It's a term that you'll find in a study of Islam in almost any time period in any part of the world. So in some sense, it's an enduring social group. You can find tongue in cheek ulamologies for most periods of Islamic history in most places, but what they were changed a lot over time. One of the arguments that the book makes is that as we follow Islamic history more generally, where we have these the many increasing many more forms of knowledge brought into the fold as uncontroversial part of the planks of the canon that any educated person should know, the ulama became even more and more polymathic. They became more and more the sorts of things that that an average scholar would learn. It became more and more diverse. And so by the 19th century, that's kind of come to reaches zenith in some ways. So the idea of ulama is enduring, but what they actually were, who they were, changes quite a bit. And I can say more about that, but you were also asking about sources. And I think that one of the first things that there's a connection between the fact that I just mentioned that you can find ulamologies of so many different societies and the question of sources. The ulama are the learned elite. They are scholars, they are literate, and they write about themselves a lot. And Central Asia is no exception. So we tend to, in many different societies, we tend to have a lot of sources that are produced by the ulama about the ulama. That said, the nature of those sources are very, very different. I do make an argument in the book for reading across different kinds of different genres of sources so that we don't end up unintentionally just reproducing and describing the genre itself rather than getting at the underlying phenomena.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about the kind of knowledge, or the very specific forms of knowledge that these ulama kind of master in the time that you're looking at. Because, like the title of the book reflects, what you're pointing out is that they do kind of reach kind of a very elite level of being able to, operate in medicine, astronomy, various sciences, even the occult. So what's the main point here? Are you bringing something new to the conversation by pointing out, just how they managed to master these various areas of knowledge?
Yeah, I think so. In a way, this is the big intervention that I want to make. And this is even this is why I chose this title for the book, Polymaths of Islam. So if you look at a lot, particularly earlier scholarship, but really any kind of scholarship, like the ulama is a lot of the time synonymous with the jurist specifically, right? Like these are, in the colonial literature, they come across as sort of fanatical mullahs, but even in modern scholarship, the ulama are the masters of Islamic law a lot of the time. It's the persona that they adopt. The ulama is one. So now I'm sort of repeating the received wisdom here, not my argument. So the ulama, if we say that they're sort of synonymous with the jurists, with the legal specialists, then who else is there? Well, there's the Sufis, and then there's the poets, and then there's the occultists, like you mentioned. There's the specialists in medicine, the physicians, right? And these are all different social groups. That's how it's usually seen, and sometimes they are even opposed to one another. So you have the ulama as the austere sort of no nonsense, buzzkill jurists, and then you have the Sufis as the more cosmopolitan alternative to them, or something like that. And so rethinking these figures as polymaths of Islam, I'm asking that we reconsider that entirely, and instead of thinking in terms of social groups, we should think about them as one integrated social group. And then we should think about different forms of knowledge and different social roles that are performed by those same group of people in different social circumstances. One of the most enduring binaries in the literature is sort of ulama versus Sufis. These are different groups. I imagine most people will have seen that articulated in the literature somewhere. It's difficult to find any ulama at all who weren't Sufism itself is a very difficult, it has a lot of different definitions, but by one definition or another, all of the ulama were practicing some kind of Sufism, which again is all, this is a point I make in more detail in the book, but that Sufism means a lot of different things. But by one or another definition, they're all practicing Sufism. And similarly, most people that we think of Sufis, I mean, they not only do they have a madrasa education under their belt, you know, and therefore becoming themselves knowledgeable, which is the definition of ulama, they're usually using that madrasa education as a way, as a platform for pursuing Sufi disciplines as a kind of postgraduate kind of form of education. So I think I consider this a fairly significant conceptual intervention, like to really move away from thinking about these different social roles, these different forms of knowledge, which, by the way, correspond to genres, which is another reason I'm interested, which relates to my previous point. But instead, again, thinking about how it could be that an individual scholar could perform personas that seem to us so different in hindsight in different contexts, you know. So, working in a, and this was very common, you know, working in a Sharia court in the morning and then heading over to the Sufi lodge to preside over it as a sheikh in the evening. This is very, very, where you might also practice the occult sciences and write Persian poetry. So this is very much an integrated milieu in that way.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit more about both Sufi learning and the occult, because in the book you write, and I quote, "By the early modern period, the lines between scholar and mystic had begun to blur." And you say that most intellectuals were a bit of both. What defines the occult? When you're reading these sources, are they referring to it as the occult, or is that kind of a modern label that we're putting on a certain set of practices? Because that was kind of a question I had, was like, okay, well, if they are kind of engaging with the occult, maybe they didn't recognize it as such.
Right. In this case, in the case of the occult, we are actually in a somewhat fortunate position in that there's an emic or a sort of a term in the tradition itself that corresponds pretty well to what we usually mean by the occult. So ulume gharib, which is like that's usually what, when I use the word occult, following scholars like Matt Melvin Kushki, who's doing pioneering work on Islamic occult sciences, that's usually that maps pretty well to that term. I mean, within ulume gharib, the occult science, what we would call the occult sciences, there's lots of specific disciplines that were variously grouped under that heading. I want to emphasize that these were understood as Islamic disciplines, right? So there was nothing, this wasn't something that the occult sciences were not something that the ulama practiced on the side and were embarrassed of. You know, they were sometimes criticized, but then that's true of a lot of other disciplines of Islamic learning as well. I mean, there were debates within the field, but they weren't seen as something, you know, outside of the Islamic fold. That's something that no respectable alim would, or no respectable scholar would actually do. The various occult sciences were elite, as in, you know, not unlike some of the other disciplines, it was not something that necessarily everyone would have done, but it was very common. And they appear in the sources, it's not in hushed whispers as something to be embarrassed of. They're valorized. It's a mark of specialized erudition. There are kinds of sorcery that are not understood in that way, that were considered outside the fold, but they don't get mentioned in these sources as much.
And can you provide, I thought this was a really interesting part of the book and not something that I typically encounter. So I was wondering if you could describe some of these practices, which you do in the book in detail.
One of the points that I make in the, so what, one of the ways that I came to be interested in this is, you know, I mean, I've, one of the source types of sources that I'm especially interested in are, this would be a kind of a roundabout way to answer that question, but there's these practical manuals called Jung, and what they are is they're kind of just notebooks of miscellany. So like when I make this argument about the eclecticism of the ulama, I'm doing that based on a number of different kinds of sources, but the Jung are a great example of where it all comes together. So that you can imagine these as a quick notebook that a scholar would take around with them and just record anything that's useful in their different situations. So, you know, and so like, so you can see for an individual, within an individual scholar's notebook, you can see all of the different, you know, this whole constellation of forms of different forms of Islamic learning coming into one place. So, you know, they'll have notes, they'll have, you know, notes about common answers to questions in Islamic jurisprudence that they'll use as a model for fatwas and legal rulings. They'll have Persian poetry written into the margins. They'll have Sufi litanies. They'll have, you know, I think even things like recipes and that kind of thing. But also, so when I was doing my research, I also started noticing strange symbols in the margins of these things, you know, dots connected by lines and that sort of thing, or numbers just written in strange patterns. And what I eventually realized was that these were occult, usually some kind of divination. So there's various different ways of doing it. There's different there's different disciplines within occultism in Islam. But a lot of them involve using letters or numbers or geometric forms, geomancy, to predict the future. In addition to ones that people are probably more familiar with, like astrology and that kind of thing. But these appear in the manuals that are, you know, primarily dedicated to things like law or medicine, right? So that's one of the main functions that that people are using this material to do. A lot of it has to do with predicting the future or influencing the future to a degree.
Yeah, thank you. And just while we're still on this conversation, you mentioned earlier that part of what you're trying to do with this focus on these various areas of knowledge is kind of present, I would say, like almost a more sympathetic view of the ulama, you know, especially because I think, like you've mentioned, kind of Jadidist, so Muslim reformist, and both in kind of Russian views of the ulama have kind of shaped the way that both Russian, Uzbek, you know, Central Asian scholars and also scholars in the West have traditionally talked about them. You mentioned kind of the idea of like the fanatic judge. And so it seems to me that what you are trying to do is present a more sympathetic view, but also to show that perhaps we really truly don't understand the ways that these ulema operate within society. And to do so, you kind of talk about some of the tensions and controversies in their practices. You know, we've talked about the occult practices, but you also talk about the use of opium and wine as a way of challenging our kind of presentist views of the ulema. And I'm wondering, I don't know, what's the bigger takeaway here for early modern Central Asia? Does it help us understand any of the big, what are the bigger questions that we can answer by looking at this specific group? And I guess what I'm also asking is, how do the ulama relate to other kind of elite groups at the time that you're looking at?
Got it. Yeah, you might have to remind me of some of the different parts of that question, but I'll take the first one, which is sort of about whether I'm trying to revise this into a more sympathetic view of the ulama. And you know, like my answer might not be what you'd necessarily expect on that question, which is just to say that you're right. If we're coming from sort of earlier scholarship that's you know, taking colonial and Jadid sources more at face value to vilify the ulama who were there, you know, who were their enemies, then sure. Yeah. I definitely think that needs to be revised towards a more sympathetic view. The word polymath often has I mean it in a fairly literal way, as just as in people who have mastered a lot of different forms of knowledge, but it also has I acknowledge it has a fairly positive ring to it. And I wouldn't, you know, I don't necessarily like what I sometimes in some parts of the literature. I think that the ulama can come across, can be celebrated in a way that I don't intend in this book, as sometimes even as the sort of heroic, indigenous resistors of colonialism. I really don't see it that way. in the sense that we just have to remember that these are really, really powerful individuals. They have tremendous power over other people's lives, and there were, you know, a lot of people below them. So if you're coming from a celebratory perspective, then I maybe would want to sort of moderate it the other direction. But you're right. If you're coming from especially earlier scholarship and Central Asian studies, then yeah, I would probably want to reassess the how we evaluate them. Okay, so that, what was the next part of your question?
Yeah. Let me restate the question. No, I was trying to do too much at once. So in the later chapters of the book, you kind of look in the middle chapters, you're kind of looking specifically at the ulama and the kind of knowledge they're using. And then in the later chapters, you kind of trace specific families of scholars and try to understand kind of how the ulama as a class of people, or not class, but as a group of people in society relate to rulers, and how they kind of like support political dynasties. One point that you make is that they kind of emerge during moments of political crisis, but then come to, I mean, if we're looking at how long these scholarly families actually continue to operate and maintain their position, it's pretty impressive. So why is this happening? And specifically, what about their knowledge set or what about their position in society makes them so useful to these political dynasties like the Magdites?
Got it. Yeah. So, I mean, for my work, in the questions I'm asking, I do find it useful to think about a kind of two-pronged elite class in Central Asia. So on the one hand, you have the main subject of my book, the Islamic scholars or the ulama. On the other hand, you have the Turkic nobility. And of course, there's lots of other power holders. And as I myself emphasize, these two groups, the lines between them blur all of the time, especially in one direction, which is to say, if you think about the Turkic nobility as a group on their authority rests on their lineage and also at least a memory of their martial abilities. Right. These are things you can celebrate openly. There is a claim to authority that is explicit. And then you also have the claim to authority of the ulama, which is based on knowledge, right, on scholarship. Now, of course, you can, if you're a member of the Turkic nobility, like for instance, the Mangits, but also many other tribes, Uzbek or otherwise, you can train your, and they did this all of the time. You can style yourself as an ulama. You can learn those forms of knowledge and also become an ulama. A member of the ulama, which doesn't necessarily undermine your other, independent claim to authority based on lineage and memory of martial prowess. But one thing to keep in mind is that you can't go the other way. So, like, if you're an Islamic scholar, no amount of training is going to get you acknowledged enable you to claim that other independent kind of authority. So, even though I study the ulama, I talk about the Turkic nobility a lot because these two groups are intimately intertwined. Specifically, as you were just asking, the Turkic nobility rely on the ulama to justify their positions as rulers and also to run the government in all sorts of ways. So there's a reason that the Turkic elite are investing so many resources in building up the institutions like the madrasas that produce this class of scholars. So even though, again, the core logic of their claims to authority are distinct and independent, they're intimately, the one relies on the other in both directions. So we have this, this enduring alliance between these two social groups. Now, when we have moments of disruption, and this is, in a way, this relates directly to how I periodized the book, right? When you have these moments of disruption, sort of, some kind of insurrection, a conquest, the formation of a new dynasty, you often see new families of ulama establishing themselves in alliance with the incoming Turkic dynasty. And this makes a kind of intuitive sense, right? Like, so that, you know, the previous dynasty had been patronizing specific families of ulama. And so a new one's coming in with a new Turkic dynasty is coming in with new claims, right? So they start patronizing different dynasties of ulama who are then able to entrench themselves and perpetuate their line. And so, you know, one of the examples in the book is this, you know, this, there's a specific dynasty that gets established, whose origins are wound up in Nader Shah Afshar's conquest of Central Asia. And I can trace that lineage all the way through to the Bolshevik conquest in 1920. So they have some real staying power over centuries. And again, this is not unique in Islamic history. This has been well established. You know, there's lots of interesting parallel examples of long-standing dynasties of scholars. But it's interesting the way that these moments of disruption enable a sort of a reset, and it really puts the relationship of the ulama and the Turkic nobility into relief in these, when you see them being established in real time in the sources.
And I think this is a good time to kind of switch to one of the last points you make in the book, which is about we've talked about the persistence of these groups, but you end the title of the conclusion is United in Eclecticism. What do you mean by this term? And, you know, it seems like you're indicating that there's kind of like the ulama are the strongest, right before they're kind of swept away by the Bolshevik Revolution. And I think you're also trying to say something about just kind of the uniformity of this culture. You know, you've alluded to the fact that these ulama could kind of bounce around different cities and very easily fit into, you know, the structure of intellectual life in those various cities. So could you just elaborate a little bit on that point? And what do you mean by the title of this conclusion?
Right. So, the United in Eclecticism was sort of a pithy way of getting at this idea that that we are looking at one common social group, most of the individuals within that social group are very eclectic in the forms of knowledge that they master. Whether they're the strongest they've ever been, I'm not sure that I would necessarily say that. But what I am sort of getting at is that over the long run of Islamic history, you kind of have a sedimentary process where new form, if you go back to the very beginning, you have hadith, right? And then fiqh, another very early, within the first several centuries of Islam, you have these early forms of knowledge getting canonized into the curriculum of what a learned person should know. But as we all know from Islamic history, more and more things get added into that mix as time goes on. So, you know, for instance, we have notably the Persianate canon, right, of poetry and other, and Sufi writing and other forms of knowledge that are in the Persian medium. And I would also include, you know, Turkic, like less so in Bukhara, but in other places in Central Asia, you also have the Turkic vernacular culture being added into this ecosystem of what a scholar should know. Which is to say, you know, when I say that they're more eclectic than ever before in the long 19th century, it's not because they're, you know, better scholars necessarily or anything like that. It's just that they're standing on the on an edifice that has been built up for over a millennium. So that's what I find remarkable about the ulama in this time period is the sheer breadth of what an educated individual is often knows. Now to the question of the where part of that, how, you know, why was this edifice so remarkably wide in breadth and geographical breadth? You know, one of the arguments I make earlier on the book is that, you know, I try and trace contours of that, as in, you know, even though the broad emphasis I'm making is that this skill set and these forms of knowledge were transferable, they weren't equally transferable everywhere. Different pieces of it were different in different places. You know, an example would just be, say, Qajar, Iran. So when people hear the word Persianate, of course, they want to, Iran comes to mind, for better or for worse. And actually, there weren't a lot of Iranian scholars showing up in the Bukharan madrasas. And the reason is, the reason is because parts of the curriculum in Qajar, Iran that would have been transferable, they exist, you know, so the poetical canon, for instance, but other parts don't. I mean, the Sunni Shia split matters in the sense that, you know, they're learning Hanafi law in Bukhara, which is, you can't use that as an employable skill in Iran, for instance. So you can trace contours, but many parts of that common curriculum, that common intellectual edifice, allow these scholars to move beyond Bukhara, which is one of the reasons that Bukhara's educational infrastructure was so much grander than the actual political boundaries of the city.
Yeah, thank you. And I think that might be a good place to stop our discussion. Of course, for the listeners, if you are interested in learning more, I would encourage you to pick up James's book, Polymaths of Islam. And James, I wanted to thank you for coming on the show. But before we say goodbye, I was curious if you're working on any current projects or if you have any future projects in mind that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, so I'm currently working on a study of what it meant to be a protectorate in the Russian Empire, but also looking at indirect rule and sort of semi-colonialism in India as well as a comparison with Bukhara. One of the as I mentioned earlier in this interview, one of the things that I was really struck by is how different a picture we get of Central Asian history when we read in different kinds of sources. And that may be obvious, but, you know, a lot of studies are really rooted in one particular register. So, like, for instance, whether that's colonial sources or whether it's a particular genre of manuscripts. And specifically, the picture that the documentary record, so like as in sort of practical documents produced by the Bukharan Emirate, the picture that you get from of what's going on is really quite different from the codified, you know, the very deliberate manuscripts that the ulama are writing. All the ulama are writing the documents too, so it's not necessarily a difference in who's producing them. But that got me more interested in questions of, you know, what did it mean? So, you know, one thing that maybe I should have emphasized at the very beginning is one of the reasons that the picture looks so different in Bukhara than in other areas of Central Asia is that Bukhara was the dynasty remained intact even after its defeat by Russia, which means that from the ulama's perspective, you know, there's a lot more continuity across the colonial divide than there would have been from the ulama's perspective living in, say, Tashkent or somewhere like that, that was now being directly ruled by the Russian military governor generalship. You know, what does that mean from the perspective of Bukhara? So, like, what are the advantages? What are the disadvantages? How does Bukhara start to look more and more like a directly ruled part of Russian Central Asia? And which ways did this actually afford opportunities to invest in things like madrasas? You know, one of the points I make in the book, in the Polymaths of Islam, is that madrasa production continues and even increases during the colonial period. So I'm interested in investigating that further, and especially as revealed through this through the documents produced by that state. Those documents led me to an interest in doing this as a comparison with Hyderabad in South Asia. You know, similarly Muslim Persianate, similarly indirectly ruled princely state in India, as a way of having the source base for both these two places help shed light on one another. This book is obviously Polymaths of Islam is very much about Central Asia, but I spent quite a bit of time living and working in India as well, digging through those archives to shed light on Bukhara. So that gave me a chance to start down this road of of comparing those two places.
Yeah, and I think, you know, unfortunately, we don't have enough comparative history being done in Central Asia. So it sounds like that book will, well, I'm certainly looking forward to it. And who knows, hope, you know, once it's published and you've done all the research, maybe we'll be able to have you back on the show to talk about.
Yeah, and what are the... I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting about that topic is just that it's, I consider that the project to be both comparative and transregional. So like it's comparative in the sort of, as a study of sovereignty. So like, what does it mean? What does indirect rule mean in these two contexts? It's comparative, but for some of the reasons that we discussed at some length in this interview, it's also transregional in terms of a study of Persianate cultures of documentation, right? So looking at the ways that bureaucracies and chanceries were shaped by this common Persian cosmopolis that was common to both Hyderabad and Bukhara. So,
yeah. Great. Well, thank you again, James, for your time. And we'll look forward to following your future research.
No, thank you. And thank you for hosting this series. It's a tremendous service to the field.